This is Taking Aim with
Rav Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Spider Web, Kidnapping, Dungeons, and Torture. On Monday, September 18th, a Canadian government commission issued a scathing report condemning both Canada and the United States for the deportation of Maher Arar, a Canadian citizen who was kidnapped by the Immigration Services and the CIA from John F. Kennedy Airport in New York and sent to Syria, where he was tortured and placed in a dungeon for over 1 year. Maher Arar, an engineer, was kidnapped on the basis of false information provided by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, in particular its intelligence unit, Project AO. As the Justice Dennis R. O'Connor, the head of the commission, said at a news conference, there is no evidence to indicate that Mr. Arar has committed any offense or that his activities constituted a threat to the security of Canada. Today on Taking Aim, we will discuss the case of Maher Arar, who was seized September 26, 2002, on his way home from a holiday with his family in Tunisia. As well, we will discuss the case of many people kidnapped, sent to dungeons overseas, and tortured. In particular, let us look not only at the three-volume report of the Canadian inquiry, but let us look at the report of Dick Marty of Switzerland, the rapporteur for the Council of Europe's incredible report issued June 7, 2006, alleged secret detentions and unlawful interstate transfers involving Council of Europe member states. He terms the extraordinary renditions the secret prisons of the CIA and its collaboration with many nations, European nations and nations throughout the world. He calls it the vast spider web. And what does it include? It includes, as he states in his remarkable report, stopover points in Prestwick, Glasgow, Scotland, Shannon, Ireland, Roma Ciampano, Italy, Athens, Greece, in the Azores, Bangor, Prague, Czechoslovakia, staging points, most notably from Dulles Airport in Washington, Frankfurt, Germany, Andana in Sirlik in Turkey, Ramstein, Germany, Larnaca, Cyprus, Majorca, and Baku, Azerbaijan. Pickup points, Stockholm, Sweden, Banjul, Gambia, Skopje, Macedonia, Aviano, Italy, and Tuzla, a military base in Bosnia. And most of all, the detainee transfer, the drop-off points, particularly Cairo, Egypt, Amman, Jordan, Islamabad, Pakistan, Rabat, Morocco, Kabul, Afghanistan, Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, Timisoara, Bucharest, Romania, Tashkent, Uzbekistan, Algiers in Algeria, Baghdad in Iraq, and Sizmani in Poland, and as well, Romania. Today on Taking Aim, the spider web. Ralph?
I think it's important to understand, as we look at this, Maya, that the spider web of a series of dungeons and prisons that are centers for sustained torture are targeting those who oppose the governmental policies of those who rule the United States. And any who do so are labeled terrorists. And the meaning of being a terrorist is simply that one is in struggle against the local regime or its sponsors. And if that struggle entails even the resort to armed force, whether as a defensive response or because the regime is autocratic, automatically then the party is designated a terrorist. And as a terrorist, anything is permissible. And, of course, then the category of illegal enemy combatant has been contrived, and we will be discussing this, which is simply a rubric for defining any victim, any target, as outside of the parameters of any normal protections, whether it be the Geneva Convention or the due process guarantees of the American Constitution or the assumption of innocence or the entitlement to a due process trial or to be able to observe evidence presented against one. All of these protections that date back to the 12th century, the Magna Carta, and before that with Henry II with habeas corpus, by the wayside. By that criterion, and we're going to get into the particulars in a minute, but I want to make this point. By that criterion, any of those who resisted the Nazi occupation of Europe, in the resistance in France, in the resistance in Denmark, in the resistance in Yugoslavia, in the resistance in Norway, in the resistance in Holland, would have qualified for this category and this treatment. For these were people who took up armed struggle against an occupying army, and these were people who resisted the regimes that were puppet regimes of the Nazi occupation by means of struggle, by targeting people in uniform, by using bombs even in cafes where gathered the soldiers and officers of the Third Reich. Any who resist imperialism today qualify in this regard. And all elements of the American ruling class, Republican and Democrat, in every administration, that makes the assumption that all protections for the citizenry can be swept away if they are designated as terrorists, enemy combatants, or the like.
Ralph, not only do we have people who oppose the ruling class, we also have people such as Maher Arar who are what you might say just innocent bystanders who are swept up, who are claimed to be terrorists, but have no relationship even to opposition to the ruling class. In this amazing report that was prepared in Canada and has not been publicly released and should in its full statement be released, it's a three-volume report. It involved 8 months, mostly private hearings, 65 sessions that were closed to the public, including to Ara himself, and then 2 months of public hearings. And what was disclosed in this report is that Project AO, this division of the Canadian Royal Mounties, Mounted Police, this new intelligence division, that they had been spying on Mr. Ara because he had a meeting at Mango's Cafe in Ottawa. He had a 20-minute conversation outside the restaurant where he was discussing inexpensive inkjet printer cartridges, that he had applied with his wife for an apartment, and he had listed one of the people with whom he had spoken, Mr. Almecki, as an emergency contact. He had been working with Mr. Almecki. And consequently, the Royal Mounted Police asked customs officials to put Mr. Ara and his wife on a terrorist lookout list. Now, Mr. Ara was born in Lebanon. His parents moved to Syria. And when he was a teenager, they moved to the United States. And he was a graduate of McGill University. He was an engineer. His wife is now a teacher. And he was just having a conversation in a cafe about inkjet printers. Now, this has all come out. Yet he was put on a terrorist lookout list. There was no evidence of any of this. The database was then sent to U.S. border officers, and they were told to look out for Mr. Ara. He and his wife were reported, quote, as Islamic extremists suspected of being linked to the Al-Qaeda movement. The Mounted Police not only gave this to the Border Patrol, they gave this information to the FBI and other American authorities. This is the work of Project AO in Canada. The handover of the data, according to the report, violated the force's own guidelines, but they justified this on the basis that since September 11, 2001, none of their guidelines ever applied.
Look, Maya, let's put this in its proper context. One, the category of terror is a false category. The category of terror refers to any opposition across the board. The irony about this is that the rubric under which the Gestapo waged its death campaign against all who opposed Nazi rule was that they were labeled terrorists. And of course, with respect to the category of terror, it's important to understand that all that we are describing here with regard to secret detentions and the dungeons and the spider web of prisons and detention camps and concentration camps across the planet and the torture that unfolds within them is not sui generis. It's not unique. It hasn't just occurred in relation to September 11th. What, for example, was Operation Condor? Operation Condor was run by the Central Intelligence Agency. One of its directors was Henry Kissinger, and it entailed what was called the Dirty War in Latin America. That is to say, in countries like Argentina, literally tens of thousands of ordinary people who were students or teachers or trade unionists or peasant leaders or people from every walk of life were rounded up and disappeared and tortured, and they were never heard of again. And this was replicated in Chile and in Uruguay and in Paraguay and in Brazil. And it was done for a period of 15 years, and it was replicated in countries not only in Latin America. And all of this was under the rubric of fighting, quote, the dirty war against terror. Operation Condor. One quick remark about this before we turn to the specific issue here. The former mayor of New York, Ed Koch, who was a congressman, a Democratic congressman in the House of Representatives, made the mistake, if you like, of seeking to have Intelligence Committee review of Operation Condor. He wasn't opposed to it. He just wanted to be in the loop. He got a call from the Central Intelligence Agency, as he reports, in which Ed Koch was told, there's a contract out on your life. So Congressman Koch called up the head of the Central Intelligence Agency, George Herbert Walker Bush. He said, George, I just had a call from your people telling me that there's a contract out on my life. I want some protection. We don't do protection, Ed, was the response from George Bush, Sr. You don't do protection. My life's being threatened. There's a contract out on me. What do you mean? I'm a congressman. We don't do protection, George. Well, what do you want me to do, George, said Ed Koch, and the response was, Ed, I suggest that you should be very careful. No ambiguity here. What we're describing with respect to MAHA is the template of a system in terminal decay. This is the concentration now of the elimination of normal protections in the formal facade. It's no longer people outside our frontiers alone. It's anybody and everybody who opposes our system of rule, the capitalist order. That's what is at stake here. That's what this network is about. And fundamental to this is the fact that these are contrived events, because the nominal terrorists are invariably intelligence operatives themselves ensnaring people to create a rationale for the massive repression which is unfolding before our eyes.
Yes, massive repression, and it is sweeping people up into the spider web. Whether you go to a cafe, and if you are of Arabic descent, you are going to be suspect. That is the message that is being given out by the Canadian officialdom and the United States. And at the time of the disappearance of Maher, when his wife and the Canadian officials approached Attorney General John Ashcroft at the time, he agreed that this was the right thing to do. Although there was no evidence, and the United States has refused to provide any evidence, any documentation of its actions against Maher Arar. And he is only one of many people who have been released through pressure from their governments, from Guantanamo, and the people who remain in the dungeons of Guantanamo, many people who have been swept up, falsely accused, and as you say, Ralph, there is no truth to any of these accusations. If you want to read more about Maher Arar and the Canadian report, the New York Times, September 19th, and the Washington Post on June 26, 2005. This is September 19th of this year, and then going back to the Washington Post of June 26, 2005, there is another article about the inquiry and exposing Canada's roles in renditions by Doug Strzok, and in the New York Times, it's an article by Ian Austin.
Well, Maya, let me just say this about the Ian Austin piece. It's quite summary, and it's quite excellent. It makes the point that the Government Commission of Canada exonerated Maher of any acts whatsoever. The report said that American officials had imposed upon the Canadian authorities their plans for detaining and torturing and transporting Mr. Ara to Syria. Quote, I am able to say categorically, there is no evidence to indicate that Mr. Ara has committed any offense or that his activities constitute any threat, said Justice Dennis R. O'Connor, as you had cited, Maya. But it goes on to cite that the Canadian intelligence authorities, under the direction of the CIA, picked this man arbitrarily, undoubtedly because of his Arab origins, but notwithstanding that, he is an object lesson. The torment that we will describe to which he was subjected, which is generalized amongst literally tens of thousands of like individuals, often set up the, quote, terrorist targets, the prime suspects, the ones who have been tortured unspeakably, turn out to have been intelligence informants and operatives from the get-go, funded by the CIA. This is an apparatus and an operation designed to rationalize, justify, and to prepare the architecture of the fascist state. One more point about this, Maya. In yesterday's New York Times, Bob Herbert, who is a liberal black columnist for the Times, ran a column which was called The System is Busted. And what he replicates in this article is the data that shows the entire population in the United States is profoundly disaffected, disillusioned about the political process, suspicious of all the lies that come out of government, no longer willing to take at face value anything that they are told, and so alienated that they have no hope and no expectation from those who hold office. And he goes on to indicate that the population itself is in such a mood that the government itself is frightened of the population and is determined to suppress any potential resistance. I mean, it's an extraordinary acknowledgement on the part of a bourgeois columnist in the New York Times what this underlying premise of all this terror really is about. It's class war. It's a war of subjugation against a population that can no longer receive the most elementary servicing of their needs, of their expectations, of their hopes, of their aspirations, as their economic wherewithal is being stripped from them on a relentless basis. That is the nature of a system in decay, and that is the underlying premise of a system of repression and a fascist-like rule, a Gestapo on a global scale, which is what this rendition is fundamentally about.
And, Ralph, the case of Maher Ara has received the most press attention here in the United States. But while he was in the Syrian prison, he saw before him, haggard and destroyed, another person who understood his English. And this was another Canadian in the same Syrian prison. The man, Abdullah Abmalki, was in prison for over 2 years. Also, other Canadians, a Kuwaiti-born Ahmed Abu Almaty, and others. The Canadian investigation looked at the case of three Canadians, the Iraqi-born Muhideen Nuruddin, also released after being tortured in Syria. They were brought there, and the false information of the Canadian Mounted Police, this Project AO, with collaboration of the FBI, the INS, and most importantly, the CIA. This was known at the top levels of the U.S. In order for these people to be taken from U.S. territory, from John F. Kennedy Airport, for instance, in the case of Ara, there had to be a sign-off by one of the deputies in the Justice Department. And this person was named in one of the reports. So let's go on and look at the actual spider web. This incredible documentation is available on the Internet. Not only this document from the Parliamentary Assembly, the Dick Marty document, but the basis for it also reports by Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International. And today and on the weeks to come, we will be citing from these amazing reports, the interviews, and the actual tracking of the airplanes. We've discussed this over a year ago on Taking Aim when Dana Priest's article in the Washington Post came out at the end of 2005, and we referred to programs and documentation that had taken that was revealed in Sweden, and we've also discussed later on the famous case of Abu Omar, who was abducted and in Italy, and for whom, in that case, the Italian government has been obstructing the investigation, where Italian magistrates have put out arrest warrants for 22 CIA agents. Ralph, let us go on and look at the spider web in great detail.
Well, one of the points here that is made clearly in the beginning pages of this fact-intensive document, and in its very dispassionate and detached manner, the horror of it comes across even more powerfully than rhetoric would accomplish. It's sort of dry and it's matter of fact, and in its relentless setting forth of what is done to people, it staggers the mind and the imagination. But in regard to that, I want to make a particular point. One of the interesting and fundamental aspects of this documentation about the, quote, global spider web is its section on the evolution of the rendition program. Because I think it's important for us to take careful note of the fact that all of this rendition program and the stripping away of any rights and the ability to simply disappear people, round them up with gangs of people dressed totally in black, snatching people off the streets, putting them into airplanes, cutting away their clothing, putting them in diapers, putting fingers and other objects up their anus, almost instantly drugging them, and then immediately subjecting them to unspeakable torture on their way to... All of this is not the result of the Bushmen. They are but the little continuation. Quote, "The evolution, during a recent mission to the United States, a member of my team came in contact with insider sources in the U.S. intelligence community. The most prominent figure was Mr. Michael Scheuer, who designed the rendition program in 1990 under the Clinton administration and remained employed by the Central Intelligence Agency for this objective until November 2004. Now, Scheuer's testimony are reported verbatim in the report, but what I want to emphasize here is, quote, "The global spiderweb of secret detentions and unlawful interstate transfers arises from Michael Scheuer as chief of the, quote, Bin Laden unit and the CIA Counterterrorism Center." And this is going on, brothers and sisters, prior to 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center, let alone September 11th. All of this is, the whole architecture is in place. You know what they're doing? They've got the apparatus in place to torture people across the board, to disappear people wherever they are, before they've even set in motion the pretexts on the basis of which this is being sold to the peoples of the world, where everybody is intimidated and expected to bow down before the necessity to fight the war on terror. They were fighting the war against us before they invented the category of terror to rationalize what they had already been doing.
Ralph, what you speak, the setting up of the Extraordinary Rendition Program during the Clinton administration, is referred to in the Maury report, but it is gone into in great detail by Jane Mayer in Outsourcing Torture, an extensive article that has been referred to by many, many investigators. Outsourcing Torture appeared in the New Yorker February 14th, 2005. And in it, she quotes from Michael Scheuer, who now lives in Northern Virginia and has spoken openly about the CIA's involvement in extraordinary rendition. And he says when he was head of the CIA's Islamic Militant Unit, was called, his job was to, quote, detect, disrupt, and dismantle so-called terrorist operations. And he stated specifically, "We went to the White House, which was then occupied by the Clinton administration, and they said, do it." He added that Richard Clark, who was in charge of counterterrorism for the National Security Council, offered no advice. He told me, figure it out by yourself. And figure it out is what they did. They went, first of all, to Egypt. And he said, Egypt was the largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid after Israel. It's a key strategic ally, but most of all, its secret police force, the Mukhabarat, has a reputation for brutality. And it's often cited by the State Department for torture of prisoners. And she cites a 2002 report, State Department report. Detainees, quote, were stripped and blindfolded, suspended from a ceiling or doorframe with feet just touching the floor, beaten with fists, whips, metal rods, or other objects, subjected to electrical shock and doused with water, and sexually assaulted. Now, this is just the tip of what the torture iceberg really reveals, as evidenced by the interviews with the people themselves who were sent by the CIA to Egypt.
Let me mention something about this, Maya, because we will have to deal in at length with the role of Egypt as the place of rendition of a prime favor on the part of the Central Intelligence Agency. I was talking to Lynn Stewart last night, and we were discussing some aspects of this in relation to her own case, because after all, Lynn was the lawyer for the blind Egyptian cleric, Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman, who was framed for the blowing up of the World Trade Center in 1993, which is you know, the entire rationale for all of this false category of terror stuff. Interestingly enough, as Lynn was mentioning to me, I didn't know this, and the State Department does a report each year about torture and governments that are almost listed as rogue governments because of their total abrogation of any rights. And interestingly enough, in the State Department report with respect to Egypt, they not only lay out the fact that torture is routine, but no opposition is tolerated, and anyone who opposes the government is subject to disappearance and unspeakable torture. And there's a passage in that description by the State Department in which it says, removal of the government in Egypt cannot be accomplished by peaceful means. Think about that, brothers and sisters. The State Department is acknowledging that so brutal and so arbitrary and so tyrannical and so devoid of any rights of any nature, any entitlement to oppose politically, is this regime in Egypt, that it is impossible to assert democratic entitlement on the part of the population with the State Department's own acknowledgement by peaceful means. What would the American revolutionaries have said about tyranny of this nature but that it must be overthrown? And therefore, those who resist are categorized as demonic figures and terrorists. And ironically enough, the people who set them up and who proposed this and that action always show themselves to have been, in fact, operatives of the United States authorities themselves, entrapping those who would desire properly to remove such a regime so they can be subjected to the treatment we are describing here today.
Ralph, let us go to some of the specifics. The Parliamentary Ombudsman of Sweden conducted interviews and an investigation. It's called the SAPO, the case number 2169, 2004, September 30th, 2004. And this was the result of the detention, the kidnapping of two Egyptians who had sought political asylum in Sweden. This is Dr. Ahmed Agiza and Mohammed Al-Ziri, who is called Al-Zari. And their abduction was witnessed and reported to the Swedish police. And as a result, there was an investigation and there was an incredible documentary that was shown on Swedish television, TV4, the program called Facts. And in it, the actual method of what the CIA does with the prisoners once they kidnap them and get them on the airplane, that process was elaborated in great detail. And Maury puts it forward as thus. The general characteristics of the security check can be established from a host of testimonies, and most of all from the Swedish interviews and the investigation in Sweden. In which case, by the way, the Swedish government was condemned in this investigation. It generally takes place in a small room, a locker room, a police reception area at the airport or a transit facility nearby. The man is sometimes blindfolded when the operation begins or will be blindfolded quickly and remain so throughout most of the operation. 4 to 6 CIA agents perform the operation in a highly disciplined, consistent fashion. They're dressed in black, either civilian clothes or special uniforms, wearing black gloves with their full faces covered. It's described by many people as they look like ninjas, big people in black baklavas, dressed in black like ninjas, or wearing ordinary clothes but hooded. The CIA agents don't utter a word when they communicate with one another. They use hand signals, or they simply know what they're to do implicitly. Some men speak of being punched or shoved by the agents in the beginning and roughed up in a brutal fashion. Others talk about just being gripped firmly from several sides. Their hands, their feet are shackled. A man has all his clothes, including his underwear, cut from his body by knives or scissors in a methodical fashion in order to demean the people. It's as if all their clothes and every part of their body is being felt up. Then they are subjected to a full body cavity search, which involves close examination of the hair, the ears, the mouth, the lips. That when they're totally naked, things are inserted into their anus, either suppositories or they are injected. They're given tranquilizers. And this also, again, not only violates a person's dignity, it is it's done in a very brutal fashion. They are then dressed in diapers, incontinence pads, loose-fitting so-called jump suits, or else they're just, it's this huge bag that's put over their head. Then they have their ears muffled and with either headphones or something tied around them so that they can't hear anything. The whole idea is to have total sensory deprivation. There are blindfolds and hoods, and these hoods have no holes, no breathing holes at all. Then they are forced aboard the airplane. They're placed on a stretcher. They're shackled. They're strapped to a mattress or a seat. They're laid down on the floor of the plane, and they're bound in uncomfortable positions so that they cannot move. Some of them are drugged, and others are not. They're made to experience the entire trip. The pain, the shackles, they were refused any water, they were refused any attendance to go to the toilet, and they have no notion of where they're going, nor the fate that awaits them. Ralph, before you speak, it's long overdue for our station identification.
Jazz Vipers at WBAI, New York City.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Spiderweb, Kidnapping, Dungeons, and Torture. Ralph?
You know, I have to say it brings to mind my, in my day, when I was imprisoned in Bolivia in a box 3x4x5, it was brutal enough at 14,000 feet, but we didn't have to put up with this. And when I was trying to get to the International War Crimes Tribunal, of which I was Secretary General for the second section, which was in Copenhagen, and I couldn't land anywhere, in Sweden, as soon as they got me off the plane in this bourgeois democracy, a social democratic government in power, the first thing that they did when they got me in was they had the police work me over. And the way, I mean, just the standard brutalization, they fractured my sternum, they, you know, ruptured the one eye, all of that. But this was just plain old fists and thumping and brutality. What we're describing here goes beyond that. far beyond the simple brutality which is the norm of every imprisonment under the officials answering to capitalist authority. What we're describing here is something that was acknowledged by Kofor Black, the head of the CIA Counterterrorism Center, in his testimony before the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, embraced by all members of both parties. He says, all you have to know here is that there was a before 9/11 and an after, and now the gloves have come off. The gloves have come off. It's not just that the gloves have come off. You have now a scientific method of tormenting and torturing people, of removing them from conscious awareness of what's being done to them. They're being drugged. They are being put through a dissociation of sensory deprivation and extreme torment that can barely be imagined and is the norm. It is the signature of the capitalist state today. In fact, if we really look carefully at what are called components of the spider's web, we find that we don't want to just father this alone on the CIA and the likes of Kofor Black, because the Marty Report establishes, in addition to the CIA black spot, black sites, the spider's web encompasses a wider network of detention facilities run by many branches of the United States government. Examples reported in the public domain include bases across the globe, military prisons, dungeons that are not acknowledged to exist, and they are being operated by unnamed agencies beyond the Central Intelligence Agency, many, many branches of the so-called, I love this euphemism, the intelligence community. You know, if only you could have seen the Führer when he was listening to Mozart. Community? This is the murder apparatus of the capitalist state. It is a torture, torment, and a fiendish method of suppression, of subjugation, and of the denial of any semblance of human dignity to all who are subject to its rule.
Ralph, let's look at one of these dungeons, and this is one that's actually operated by the U.S., and where many of the people who are kidnapped, the extraordinary rendition, are taken for part of the time. Many people, as I said, are taken to Egypt, they're taken to Syria, they're taken to Jordan, they're taken to places in Europe, in Romania, Poland, other countries. But one of the worst is operated by the United States, and in a report of Human Rights Watch, U.S.-operated secret dark prison in Kabul. Eight detainees now held at Guantanamo described to their attorneys, and they described, these are independent descriptions, and Human Rights Watch makes the point that these people don't know each other, their attorneys don't know each other, and these were independent descriptions, and they corroborate each other. They were held at a facility near Kabul at various times between 2002 and 2004. The detainees called the facility the dark prison, or prison of darkness. They were chained to walls, deprived of food and drinking water, and kept in total darkness with loud rap, heavy metal music, or sounds that blared for weeks at a time. The U.S. interrogators slapped or punched them during interrogation. They were held in complete darkness for weeks on end, shackled to rings bolted into the walls of their cell with the loud music and other sounds played continuously. Some detainees said they were shackled in a manner that made it impossible to lie down or sleep, with restraints that caused their hands and wrists to swell up or bruise. They were deprived of food for days at a time and given only filthy water to drink. They were held incommunicado, never visited by the representatives of the International Committee of the Red Cross or other independent officials. And we should also note that both Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and the European rapporteurs have also substantiated that when either officials of a government, another division of the government outside of the intelligence divisions, let's say the consuls, go and ask about these people, whether it's the United States or it's the Syrian officials or the Jordanian officials or the Egyptian officials, they deny that they've ever even heard of these people, that these people are not in their clutches, when in fact there they are in these dungeons.
Yep, that's what they do. In Bolivia, when I was being interrogated, they said I didn't exist. They'd already announced that I wasn't there. By the way, sitting on the table of the interrogator was a finger of Che Guevara. Now, nothing has changed about these people.
Ralph, let's look at some of the direct interviews that are one more horrendous than another. And we described in general what has taken place, whether it's with Bosnians or it's with Algerians or it's with people of Syrian descent, but who are citizens of Great Britain or they're seeking or Egyptians seeking asylum, or whether they live in Italy. It's going on throughout. But there are cases of two British permanent residents who were arrested in Gambia. They were there in order to seek a business venture. They were taken from Gambia with the cooperation of the Gambian government. This is Bashar al-Rawi and Jamil al-Banna. They were arrested. You can call it arrested. It's actually kidnapped. November 8th, 2002. They had gone to see Mr. al-Rawi's brother, Wahab, who's a British citizen, and help him set up a mobile peanut processing plant. But they didn't get that far. They were arrested at Gatwick, and their hand luggage was inspected. And what was interesting is they said there was a suspect item. They were held at Gatwick. They were held by the British government. The suspect item turned out to be a battery charger. But then after they went to Gambia, they were again held. And what they ended up in is at the dark prison in Kabul. The dark prison. These people were swept away. They were flown to Afghanistan. There were seven or eight American agents on board, and they said, including a woman doctor who was overseeing the torture, you know, how much treatment, how much torture they could suffer before they would actually be killed. And the CIA had a doctor there. And then they were in the dark prison where, again, they were subjected to more torture.
Well, Maya, this is a detailed report, as we've mentioned. The detention facilities are many of them spelled out. They give the example of the detention center at Timișoara in Romania. They identify the redemption airplane that carries the those who are kidnapped to this particular location. It's N313P. They give the same information with respect to Poland, and they identify the planes that routinely take people to Kabul and to Tashkent in Uzbekistan. Now, it's of particular interest to mention the Uzbekistani circumstance because the former ambassador from Great Britain to Uzbekistan, Craig Murray, did an extraordinary disclosure and indeed did a book about the subject that became the topic of interest for Don Van Atta Jr., reporter for the New York Times, growing evidence that the U.S. is sending prisoners to the torture capital. Uzbekistan is our ally. This is the New York Times on May 1st, 2005. Craig Murray describes the following. People who are taken to this torture center in Tashkent, the capital of Uzbekistan, are boiled alive. Yeah, they're boiled alive. Those who survive only have their arms or legs boiled. They cook them. They boil them. And Craig Murray was reprimanded and removed because as a diplomat, he saw fit to make public what the British authorities not only knew, but along with the American masters, were collaborating and facilitating. They're boiling people alive in these places that are being rendered there. It's not merely what we've described, which is horrific enough. There are no limits. Uzbekistan boils them alive, dismembers them in place. With pliers, they take off fingers and hands and toes, described in detail by the former United Kingdom ambassador, Craig Murray, and reported in the New York Times. There's no claim or entitlement to ignorance or pretended, what the Jesuits call, some posture of invincible ignorance, people knowing but choosing not to know. The record is absolutely unmistakable and out there. It's in your face. It's in the bourgeois press. There's no single member of this millionaire's club called Congress who is not fully cognizant of what is routine and done by way of policy across the board on the part of this ruling class. They are complicit, they are sanctioning and approving of it, and they maneuver amongst themselves merely to assign blame or credit, as the case may be, to one another of them, depending on the moment.
Ralph, let's again go to some of the cases. Binyamin Mohammed al-Habashi is an Ethiopian citizen. He had resident status in the United Kingdom since 1994. Many of his family members emigrated to the United States and were naturalized citizens here in the United States. But he stayed in the United Kingdom, and he claimed asylum. He spent 7 years pursuing his education in London while his asylum application was being considered, and it is, you can see, over 7 years, this is a very protracted process in the United States. At the age of 20, he converted to Islam. And what's interesting is he did so because he wanted to overcome a drug habit. He's now detained at Guantanamo. He was part of the first group of prisoners that are to appear before a military commission. And he has not. And it should be noted that he, along with many others in Guantanamo, have contested their stay there, and all those were turned down. What's interesting is the torture that he describes. He speaks of being wounded all over his body with a scalpel and a razor blade, beaten unconscious, hung from the wall in shackles. This was torture that was done to him before Guantanamo. He suffered gross physical injuries, broken bones. He was constantly threatened with death, rape, and electrocution. His case, according to Mari, is an example of what happens to numerous detainees. They are trapped in the U.S. spider web during the course of the so-called War on Terror. Binyamin was subjected to two CIA renditions, a U.S. military transfer to Guantanamo, and several other clandestine transfers by plane and helicopter. He was in at least two secret detention facilities, in addition to military prisons. In other words, they moved him about from place to place. And he was confronted with allegations that only could have arisen from intelligence that's provided by the United Kingdom. And this intelligence was basically who he happened to know at the mosque where he was studying. He traveled to Afghanistan in 2001. He crossed into Pakistan and then returned to the UK. He had been arrested by Pakistani officials at Karachi Airport on April 10, 2002, for attempting to travel on a false passport. He was interrogated by American officials. He asked for an attorney. They refused to provide one. The American official said to him, "The law has changed. There are no lawyers. You can cooperate with us the easy way or the hard way. If you don't talk to us, you're going to Jordan. We can't do what we want here." Of course, they do that. The Pakistanis will know what we want them to do. His story has been checked out. And Maori says his story has checked out. And in fact, at the time that he was first arrested, he should have been released. He says, "They knew that I was a nobody, but Nobody is a nobody, as Ralph has been saying over and again. They have to create the image of terrorists here, there, and everywhere. These are false statements, as the Canadian authorities have revealed in their investigation of Maher Arar. This was false information, in his instance, created by the Canadian Royal Mounted Police. And in the case of a person like Benjamin, it was created by British intelligence. Benjamin was held in Morocco. He was submerged almost all underground. Ralph.
Maya. Let's just take a few concrete instances of what is a generalized condition. This is a 67-page report of particularity. You mentioned Al-Masri, and we've been talking about Sweden. Let's just look at what the Swedish ombudsman described here. This is just the tip of the iceberg, as you say. The Central Intelligence Agency can do three of these guys in an hour. In 20 minutes, they're good to go. This is the ombudsman speaking. He says, the investigating officer for the Swedish ombudsman was amazed by the, quote, fast and efficient procedure used by the CIA agents. The general characteristics of what they do is as follows. They grab them in a small locker room. The man is blindfolded. The operation begins. Six CIA agents perform it in a highly disciplined, consistent fashion. They are dressed in black, wearing black gloves, their faces covered. They are big people in black, as you say, baklavas. Then they're back in black like ninjas. They are hooded. They don't utter a word. They communicate with one another by sign languages. They punch and shove the agents, their targets, and they grip them from several sides while the hands and feet are shackled behind them. All clothes are cut from the body, knives and scissors in a careful, methodical fashion, and then they begin to lacerate them. They lacerate them with knives, with scalpels, and with razors, according to the report here. In fact, at the end of this process, they go after their genitals in particular, and we will describe later how the routine that they do is to begin to work on the penis of the men with razors and scalpels. This is the description here in this report in particular detail. Full-body cavity search, examination of the hair, ears, mouth, and lips, and the insertion of objects therein. The men are dressed in nappies and in jumpsuits. Diapers are put on as they are handled. They are strapped to mattresses and seats. When they are on the planes, they are put in a position where they cannot move and where their arms and legs are in such unnatural position that the pain is excruciating. So this is the routine treatment of people across the board that is being described here. And it isn't just a question of the Swedes or of Al-Masri. To begin to describe here what is done in Egypt and in Bagram and in Afghanistan and in Rabat and Morocco, what I've just been reporting here pales by comparison.
Ralph, we have just a few minutes left, and I would not like to miss the case of Mohammed Haider Zamar. He's a 45-year-old Syrian-born German national. He was detained in Morocco December 2001. He was held several weeks without charge before being flown by a CIA plane to Syria, where he still remains, according to Amnesty International. And he had left Germany October 27th, 2001, to go to Morocco. Now, what's incredible here is the description of the cell in Syria, 1.85 meters long, less than 0.9 meters wide, and less than 2 meters high. That's less than 7 feet high. And what do we have? A meter is about 3 feet. His torture is common for what people say from Far Palestine. Far Palestine is the Palestine prison in Syria. And it's an underground section of Far Palestine. It's infested with rats, lice. There's no bed or mattress. It's a tomb cell. It's only you're given some filthy blankets, a plastic bottle for drinking water, and another for urine. Access to fresh air and sunlight in the yard is restricted to a maximum of 10 minutes each month.
I think we've lost her.
But can be as infrequent as 10 minutes every 6 to 8 months. And this is a description Maher Arhar describes in great detail in the same description. Ralph, do you want to sum up for this portion of Taking Aim?
I want to do the following before I do that. First of all, I want to mention that the report documents over 1,000 documented rendition flights. And, of course, there are many more than those that they can document. 1,000 flights, you're talking of thousands of people. We are giving a few illustrative examples of what is happening here. I want to summarize with the following. Binyamin Mohammed Albashi, an Ethiopian citizen who held resident status in the United Kingdom. Let's just go into briefly what has been done to him. Set upon by unidentified people dressed in black with masks, wearing what looked like Timberland boots, stripped naked, photos and fingers up his anus, dressed in a tracksuit, shackles with earphones and blindfolded, secret detention facilities in which he was held first in Morocco and then in other locations. And what did they do? The scalpel, the scalpel, the scalpel. They cut his penis into shreds. When one of the women interrogators at Guantanamo was looking at this person, she jumped back in horror. She was asked actually to handle his penis because they generally sexually abuse these prisoners, and it was mutilated flesh. This is not an isolated example. I can't begin to describe the generalized condition of horror that is inflicted upon these humans. They came in and cuffed my hands behind my back, black ski masks that only showed their eyes. They stood on each of my shoulders. They punched me in the stomach. They used electric cables that were pounding the hands and the feet and the soft tissue. This is the reality. Secret places of detention across the planet. The dark prison, the disco prison, enhanced interrogation techniques, the use of drugs. It is a spider's web, brothers and sisters. We will give a more detailed account from the Amnesty Report, the Human Rights Watch Report. We will go into the full particularity of what happens to people within the United States, people who are now designated as enemy combatants. We will relate this to the military commissions, to the absence of habeas corpus, and to the preparations of martial law. It is a spider web. It is a torment. It is a torture. It is the signature of capitalist rule today, and it is the clearest indication to us of what we need to do, brothers and sisters. This is not a spectator sport. This is a matter of survival and struggle, and it is not a question of choosing between the evil lesser. It's a matter of targeting this system and removing this fiendish torment to which all of us are now subject under the new dispensation of the capitalist order.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Spider Web, Kidnapping, Dungeons, and Torture. Our program was recorded October 31st, 2006. It is available on our program archive at www.takingaim.info and also on the WBAI archive. We'll be with you next week.
Tahrir, Liberation. Marhaba, I'm Barbara Nimri Aziz. Tahrir is a long WBAI tradition and still strong in voices of the Arab Muslim community here and abroad. I invite you to tune in Tuesday evenings at 7 for discussions on...